These are topics of Augustine's, by the way. I'll talk about what I believe Augustine felt about the importance of what we're going to talk about today, which is the suffering of the righteous. I believe it's something he saw as so important that he put it in book one of the City of God out of 22 books. He gives it front rank status. Why? He's going to be talking about the suffering of Christians and what's just happened to trigger this discussion and to put it foremost in his mind. He's writing the work. He begins writing the work in 413 AD. The Roman Imperium will see its last year in 476, a century prior to Augustine's writing in the 300s. We had had the Emperor Constantine, the first nominally and perhaps truly Christian emperor. So you see, Christianity had come into the power structure of the Roman Empire and the Roman polity around the Mediterranean so much. There had been so much proselytization, the spread of the word, and so forth, that Christianity had become a power to be reckoned with. And now it had achieved, to some degree, secular power. Or at least touch the hearts of those with secular power. It was not just something believed by hermits in a cave in Palestine. It's out in the polity now. It's there. Okay. But there had been seesaws back and forth. Right? We'd had Julian the Apostate, who had grown up Christian and turned on Christianity and started persecuting Christians. So we have a seesaw back and forth. The pagans are still very robust and pushing back. Augustine and the City of God is concerned to push them further because they're throwing out all these questions. Questions about what? What happened 3 years before he started writing this work was the sack of Rome. The sack of Rome. This was a stunning, shocking event in the history of the time. Okay, the last time it had occurred was in the Republican period. The Roman polity, by the way, lasted around 1,200 years, from kingdom to republic to empire. Rome was said to be, and was in the hearts and minds of Romans, the eternal city. It will never fall. Sounds like our speech today about the one and indivisible union. What hubris and pride. It looks like it will in time fall. Now, the eternal city just got sacked 3 years prior to the writing. People had questions. The pagans were saying, Christianity caused this. People embracing Christianity brought this on us. The gods are unpleased. Right? They're mad. Jupiter, the others, they're angry. And this is their revenge for turning away from the true faith, which was polytheism of the old Roman pagans. That's one speech. Augustine said, you're wrong. You're way wrong, and I'm going to show you. And by the way, I'm going to tell you about the suffering of the righteous. What happened to those people in Rome? Some interesting things happened. Okay. Why do good people suffer in this earthly life? Why do the wicked sometimes prosper? This event, the sacking of Rome, stimulated the thinking in Augustine and triggered him to throw this out here. And again, it's book one. It's right up front. So he's engaging in arguments against the enemies of the faith here. And that's where we come in. The first topic he takes up when he's talking about this, he observes in section 8 of book 1 that blessings, and we have to be careful about our words, blessings and disasters are often shared by the good and the bad in this earthly life. So we're talking about the earthly life. There it is. Now, the language is important. We call, in our flesh, we call things blessings that please us. We tend to do that, don't we? That's such a blessing that I got a job. It's a blessing that we have air conditioning in the house, that we have food, and we have peace and law and order and equality, and we can enjoy these things. it's a blessing that someone did this for us and so forth, just out of the blue. Some pleasant, comfortable thing, right? And we, only a more critical, thoughtful Christian says, yeah, but you know, those trials I've been through are blessings too. And people say, really? You see the difference. When you cross the line from the comfortable into the painful, you lose a lot of people. Because in our flesh, we think that that which is comfortable is the blessing and nothing else. And of course, that's wrong. So we're careful about our words here. And in order to sharpen the words, we can use some of our Puritan thinkers like John Flavel and others. And Flavel likes to use the term comfortable provinces, right? Those with which pain is not directly associated, mental or physical pain. So it's nice to have that clarification term, comfortable provinces, or things thought to be blessings, okay? Things thought to be blessings. We can be in error. We can be in error about what is a blessing and what's not. Be careful, all right? It's what we think about a given thing in our lives. Is it a blessing or is it a curse? So notice the language of Augustine, things thought to be blessings. On the other hand, you've got, he uses the word disaster. And the etymology of the word is interesting because aster means what? Asterisk on your keyboard. It means, it's Greek, star. In Latin, stellar, like Stella. She's a little star. Aster is the Greek, meaning star. And if something is a disaster, dip means down. The stars are raining down. The stars are falling out of the sky. Something horrible has happened. You see the image? That's what a disaster is. It's when the sky is falling, Chicken Little. You see? Disaster. Okay? It's a disaster. So we contrast blessings with disasters. What are disasters? Well, disaster is a strong term. He uses it, Augustine does, in the title, the topical here. Painful or afflictive provinces. Affliction. I have an affliction. My leg or something. Right? A mental affliction. A physical affliction, a material affliction, and so forth. Painful. Pain is associated with it as opposed to comfort. So we have to watch, and we immediately, when we talk about suffering, we get into these distinctions, and we have to be clear with our words and move through it. Okay. Most of what we're going to talk about today are, since we're talking about the earthly life and the sufferings of the Christian in the earthly life, there'll be material afflictions, physical afflictions, that could include mental too, as opposed to the spiritual, right? God has left me to my desires. The worst possible thing that can happen to a man or woman is when he leaves you to yourself, is it not? Yes. You're already fallen. You're not pulled out of it. And is he going to let you just run with your desires, as he did for Pharaoh? And increased hardening. That's the worst possible thing to happen to a person, is to be left to their wicked heart's desires. That's the worst. It's not breaking your leg. It's not struggling against persecution, right persecution. Those are blessings, the apostle tells us. So, our body wants to talk about pain. But pain can be good pain, of course. Now, so just some immediate distinctions. Augustine's going to weave through some topics here within this general topic of blessings and disasters are often shared by the good and the bad. This is an observation he makes. He looks out at the earthly life and says, I see wicked men, I see good men, and they both experience the comfortable provinces and the painful ones. What's going on here providentially? Why is this so? He's asking questions about the ways of God and his providence, his seeing in front of us and what he plans for us. That's what he's doing. And he says the divine mercy extends during this earthly life even to the godless and the ungrateful. That's the first thing he observes. Why is that so? Why is that so? And he says this, it is the mercy of one who, as we're told in Matthew 5:45, who makes his sun rise on the good and on the bad. and sends rains alike on the righteous and the unrighteous. That's what we are told. We're not told why, we're told that at that point. Augustine's going to dig further into it. He says, some of the wicked are brought to penitence or repentance by observing these facts. They look around and they say, oh, okay, this is the way things are. And that is enough to bring them along according to what God's given them. And they therefore amend their impiety, while others of the wicked, more hardened, despise the riches of God's goodness and forbearance and the hardness and impenitence of their hearts, and they lay up for themselves a store of wrath in the day of God's anger and of the revelation of the just judgment of God, who will repay every man according to his deeds, Romans 2:4, right? So you've got the less hardened wicked and the more hardened, and they have different attitudes about what they see when they look around. They see some prospering and some suffering, and they see that it's mixed between the good and the wicked. And of course, they're fuzzy about what is good and what's wicked, so there's a good bit of confusion in their minds. So it gets complicated. The patience of God, Augustine says, still invites the wicked to penitence. He's very patient, long-suffering. But the patience, as R.C. Sproul likes to point out, or did to one of his students, who said, God's patience is infinite. He said, no, sir. It is not infinite. It is limited, and it will come to an end. He's very patient. He waits for the last of those predestinated to come into the fold, and then judgment. His patience is not infinite. But in his patience, for the time being, he invites the wicked to penitence, just as God's chastisement trains the good in patient endurance. Training the good, inviting the wicked. God's mercy embraces the good for their cherishing. So when he gives us a comfortable providence, for example, he's embracing us. If we're one of his, he embraces us. And you feel that, especially when you've gone without, don't you? You didn't have a job, and you got a job. You didn't have a job, and you got a job. You had an illness, and then you were made better. And you reflect on it. You reflect on his providence, and you start to appreciate your health and what you have. And you say, Lord, don't let me stray. I haven't appreciated what you've given me. So, he embraces us if we're his in comfortable provinces, and God help us that they don't corrupt us, because we're still in flesh and they may corrupt us and we may become ungrateful and fall right back. And one of Augustine's constant themes is, if you don't learn God's laws and warnings through sermons, if you're one of his, you will learn it through experience. You will be made to learn it through experience in this earthly life. If you don't listen to the sermon and take it to heart, it's coming for you when you walk out the door and experience in the world. God's mercy embraces the good for their cherishing, just as his severity chastens the wicked for their punishment. God in his providence, Augustine says, decided to prepare future blessings for the righteous, which the unrighteous will not enjoy, and future sorrows for the ungodly, with which the good will not be tormented. So we've got the idea there. We see the end business of judgment, but then he's going to pull back and say, but we're not going to talk about judgment right now. We're going to talk more about the Christian suffering in his earthly life. So he pulls back and says, let's focus on some of these aspects of God's providence for the suffering. Why has God willed that these temporal goods, goods experienced in this life, and temporal evils should befall good and bad? Now, you could question whether that's the case, but I think when we look around, we can say that he's true. He's right when we see the good and the wicked, the believers and the unbelievers in this life, suffering both comfortable and afflictive providences. We see that. It's true enough. But why? Now we get not just to that, it is the case, but why is it the case? And he's going to conjecture about why. And here he is. So that the good things should not be too eagerly coveted when it is seen that the wicked also enjoy them. Barack Obama got a Nobel Peace Prize, did he not? Did he not? That's an earthly honor, is it not? He got it. Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. That's supposed to be a high distinction and honor. It's supposed to be reserved for a person of character and intelligence. Nevertheless, we see the current occupants. And on, you could list many, many, especially in our age. What's this about? When we see good things given to the wicked, right? The believer's supposed to say, well, that kind of sours it, doesn't it? If they give me the Nobel Peace Prize, assuming I've done what used to be requisite to get it, yeah, I admit it's a bit soured by some previous recipients. All right. I think of President George Washington or President Thomas Jefferson compared to President Bill Clinton or President Barack Obama or the current occupant of the White House, which I hesitate to call president. But anyway, what a comparison. Marcus Aurelius, the good philosopher, compared to Caligula, the sadistic, wicked man. Okay? And there we go. So, the fact that good things can go to the wicked is intended by the Lord to sober us and say, don't be too worried about earthly honors because they'll give them to the dogs. Don't think too highly of yourself if you've got it. Whatever that grandiose honor position is, because after all, look at the other person who's got it. Okay? See the effect psychologically? It's meant to chill us about earthly honors. It's intended that way. The Lord intended that. It's a dispensation. One of his ways is dispensations. On the other hand, what about the afflictive provinces? Okay. Well, when it's seen that the wicked also enjoy them, and so that the evil should not be discreditably shunned. If something bad happens to you, you lose your job, you wreck your car, you come down with cancer, and you say, boy, you know, if I had maybe a Jehovah's Witness come along, they'd point at me and say, well, you had it coming. You must have been sinning in your heart. I thought, well, you haven't read Augustine, and you really haven't read Scripture. Because guess what? These things happen to the wicked and the faithful. They do. And just because a man is not dressed well and doesn't live in a fine house and works what the world would call a lowly job, there's no aspersion against him. Right? Because we see the good suffer these things as well as the bad. And that's the point. Again, it's supposed to chill us. It's supposed to push us away from this idea that, well, when we see prosperity and we see beauty and we see this and that, there must be good there. There must be good there. It's a fine house. So those people must be noble people who live in those fine houses. Really? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Chances are, statistically, you can get into that. Right, Chris? Statistically, what's the chance of a person in a fine house having noble character and being godly? Well, it gets complicated institutionally. Maybe. We won't say it's not the case. I mean, it can't be the case. It certainly is sometimes the case, right? But we know it can be otherwise easily. Now, so we're chilled away from the idea that if someone has earthly prosperity, they're necessarily good. And we're chilled away from the idea that if someone is suffering and lowly and down, that there must be something morally wrong with that person. And they got to get with the program, right? Something wrong with them. He chills us out on both of those. He refutes both of those. And we know that scriptural. Right? We come back and say, he's right. The good and the wicked suffer afflictions in this life and what we call blessings or comfortable provinces. Now, he's digging deeper into it. The most important question, he says at this point, is what use is made of the things thought to be blessings and of the things reputed evil? What use is made of them? The good man is not exalted. He's not exalted by this world's goods. You can give him Biltmore House, and you can give him high political office if he's so inclined. All these things that the world has to offer, as Satan offered Christ, right, pointing to all the kingdoms of the world. And he's the good man, apart from his flesh, and he's always struggling a bit with flesh in his life, the good man says, they're of what value to me? Nothing compared to what I will have with the Lord in heaven. You could offer me 10,000 times all the kingdoms of this world, and if my heart's true as a Christian, I will say, away with that. It is as nothing compared to communion with the Lord in heaven. That's the ideal. That should be the attitude. It's not often because of our flesh. Right? The good man is not exalted by the world's goods, nor is he overwhelmed by the world's ills. He's not exalted. He's not corrupted. And he's not demoralized by the world's ills. You can just pound him and pound him and pound him like Job was pounded. Pounded and pounded. And his own wife says, curse God and die and put an end to this. There he is on the ground, covered with sores. He's lost everything except the wife who's saying, curse God and die. Put an end to it. And he says, get away from me, Satan. I'll do no such thing. I'll do no such thing. So, he's not exalted, the good man. He's not exalted by the world's goods, and he's not overwhelmed by the world's evils. The bad man, on the other hand, the bad man, the wicked man, is punished by misfortune of this kind. When the bad man experiences afflicted providences, we'll talk about the attitude in a minute, the tone he takes, his perspective, we'll get to that. But it doesn't work to his good, right? He's burning up with resentment, spitting and cursing, right? And the flesh in a Christian does the same. I admit it. There's a tendency that way, isn't there? God has forsaken me. That sort of thing. In your weakness. And you have to turn away from that. So, the bad man's punished by misfortune of this kind. It's also corrupted by good fortune. Corrupted by good fortune. Good things. Comfortable provinces. Prosperity. Position, power, all corrupts, as Lord Acton said. Power corrupts, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely, English historian. One of the greats to bring in at this point is Jeremiah Burroughs, Puritan thinker. In his work, beautiful work, The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment, and he makes a striking claim on the expressions he uses, which I really like, talking about God's ways. He says, God's usual ways. What's he talking about? Patterns of God's behavior in his providences. God's usual ways. Burroughs says, one of God's usual ways is to work through prosperity that he gives a man to mete out wrath towards that man. Back up and think about that one. So when we look around and we see a prosperous man, we can't assume that it was, well, it's a prosperity gospel, people say, or maybe the Jehovah's say that he's a good man, he's a noble man, God's rewarding him. Maybe. Maybe not. Could be just the opposite. Could be that this man's a deep, dark unbeliever in his heart, and that God has predestinated him to hell in the after, and he's got reasons for making that man prosper in this life. And he's meting out, God is meting out his wrath towards that man in connection with other lives for his overall good purpose, best possible purpose. Wrath through prosperity. That should sober you up. Every rich man should say, what am I in my heart? What am I doing with what I've been given? Am I one of those lost, wicked ones? Is God venting his wrath on me? Because it's going to end in my dark end, if that's so. It should make them stop and think. Stop them cold in their tracks. It's possible, Augustine says. It often happens that God shows more clearly his manner of working in the distribution of good and bad fortune. Before we go into that, any questions at this point? Any questions at this point or comments? Ms. Keith?
Okay. You talk and I keep thinking of all these different things that take place in the Bible, like you mentioned Job and his friends, you know. Job was a righteous man, but his friends were getting things, so, you know, all these examples throughout Scripture for what you're saying.
Yeah, it gets complicated, and we have to be careful with our terms, but Augustine is digging down, and he's conjecturing. He's looking at Scripture saying, what are the usual ways of God and his providence, and why does he put us in a situation? How are we to understand suffering in this earthly life and be wise about it and not be simple about it, but be wise about it? That's what he's concerned about. He just wants to try to reveal to God's glory some of these complexities in his providences. After all, providence means what? Right? It means to see in front of. God's got our path. If you're one of his, you don't make your own path. He's made your path. He's made others' paths too, by the way.
And he said, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you.
That's right.
So we shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, shouldn't be a surprise, but we are.
But God says, vengeance is mine, and he will take it. So, yes. You know, we've got to happily, as best we can, live in this world with other people.
Yes, it's a challenge. Challenge with ourselves, too.
Yeah, that's true.
He's still on the section about the blessings and the sufferings for the good and the bad. And he's digging into why. He has more to say. He's going to dig in further. It often happens that God shows more clearly his manner of working in the distribution of good and bad fortune. And he goes through a number of scenarios, and I'll just go through them and let you ponder them. If judgment were obviously inflicted on every wrongdoing in this life, just imagine that, because that's not what happens, right? You do something bad, boom, judgment. You do something bad, boom, as soon as I do it, there's immediate feedback. Now, sometimes it happens, but it's relatively rare. Relatively. It doesn't happen all the time. We can agree on that. Right? I do something bad, and then I start worrying about, does the Lord see that? Does the Lord forget about that? He's going to let me slide? That's the flesh talking, right? Oh, what's going on? Ooh, boy, he knows I just told a liar, did something bad. That's the first hypothetical, and he wants to illustrate God's providence. He said, if punishment were obviously inflicted on every wrongdoing in this life, it would be supposed by us that nothing was reserved for the last judgment. What's there to be done then? If he's already done it all, you got it as you went along, right? And so that's an interesting, right, philosophical hypothetical. There's your theologian. He's going through these different possibilities. That's his job, right? Now, on the other hand, if God's power in this earthly life never punished any sin in this world, everything just running amok, right? It's Antifa all over the place. Boo! You know? Anarchy. Godlessness. And they never get punished. Nothing ever happens. Like, oh, yeah. And the good people are like, oh, we're just getting bludgeoned. We're just rope-a-dope. Getting pounded. Right? Horrible. You never see any justice at all. Period. What a hellish thing that would be, right? If that were the case, if, right, then how would we think about that? If God's power never openly punished any sin in this world, there would be an end to belief in providence. You can see how that would be so, right? People would be so demoralized, like, God, where's God? Right? You start listening to atheists saying there is no God. You're delusional. You'd be demoralized. You'd be absolutely demoralized, wouldn't you? It seems that way sometimes. Like, where's God? They just stole the election. Where's God? There's this disaster. People killed on the golf course down at Lyon. Where's God? All kinds of things happen. Where's God? So forth and so on. The flesh says that, but you have to just stick in there. Right? An astounding thing. You know, Robert E. Lee, after the war, he was on the losing side. They lost militarily, right? It didn't shake his belief in God. It didn't shake his belief in providence. He said, God has deep reasons we know not. And that he's in control and he has his reasons. Right? And this has not dissuaded me from serving my fellow man or praising the Lord. That's what he said. Robert E. Lee. If Robert E. Lee can say that after all he went through, I think I could bring myself to be a little bit better. I can't bring myself, but with God's help. Maybe I can. I know I can with his help. That's one hypothetical. If everything's immediately punished, boom. Okay, we know that's not the case, but it's interesting to think about. If nothing's ever punished in this earthly life, then we're demoralized. What then? What about good fortune? If God did not grant good fortune to some petitioners with manifest generosity, with evident generosity, right? If he never did that, then what follows? We should not suppose that these temporal blessings were his concern. Now, that's an open question. Are temporal blessings, let's say, for example, material blessings, right? Right. You could just say law and order and a polity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in New York City now, I understand they don't have any traffic law anymore. People just run through red lights, woo, you know, it's getting crazy. But law and order is a blessing. It is. Right? Security of possession. Hey, we're all here, but our homes are somewhere else, miles away. Are they secure? If we had anarchy, they wouldn't be. We probably wouldn't leave home. We'd be sitting there riding shotgun on the house, right? It may come to that soon. But, right? We take it for granted there's law and order, then our house will be there when we get home, right? And everything's okay, no one's broken in, nobody's torn a place apart, all that sort of thing, right? All these blessings, right? If he didn't grant it to some petitioners with manifest generosity, that is to say good fortune, we should not suppose that these temporal blessings were his concern. They are his concern. They are his concern, these temporal blessings. They're not to be overstated, but they are his concern because of the way he wants to train us up. They're part of his providence, these temporal blessings. They're not without value, right? We're not going to be those who are the anti-materialists who say that there's no value. No, it's part of God's providence that these things are here, right? That he gives us to enjoy them, right? They're part of the plan. If he bestowed prosperity on all just for the asking, what about that hypothetical? You ask him for something, boom, you got it. Automatic Santa Claus. You ask and it's yours. Boom, just like that. It's yours for the asking. If he did that, but that's not his mode of operating, is it? If he bestowed prosperity on all just for the asking, just by the asking, we might think that God was to be served merely for the sake of those rewards. And that any service for him would prove us not godly, but rather what? Covetous and greedy. He's just a big Santa Claus. We're not interested in him particularly. It's just what he gives us. What a nasty attitude. Right? We're just in it for the goodies. And he happens to be the giver. We don't particularly value him. That's a big problem. That's a huge problem. That's a fundamental problem. Leibniz, by the way, talks a lot about that, the German philosopher. Someday we'll get to him, perhaps. He's going to talk about valuing God for himself. Right? Appreciating what he gives you, but that's not the main concern. You're to love him and value him. And that's what Augustine's point here. Now, before I talk about how Augustine's going to discuss how the wicked react differently from the good in this earthly life to things that happen to them, their reactions. And you shall know them by their reactions. You can. You can know them by their reactions, by their fruits, which are their reactions, their indicators, there's evidence of their heart. And here he goes. So, When the good and the wicked suffer alike, let's say there's a calamity, Rome is sacked, there's a tornado, your neighborhood's wiped out, every house on the block. You've got the wicked man in house A and the good man in house B. What's the different reaction he's talking about here? Imagine that. Tornado goes through your neighborhood, right? You've got four unbelievers there and four believers in different households. They're all wiped out. Insurance claims, all that stuff. You're out there looking at the mess. But what about the different attitudes? Should be different attitudes. Christians oftentimes in their weakness fall in with the grousing of the unbelievers, obviously. What's he say? So when the good and the wicked suffer alike, the identity or the sameness of their sufferings, everybody got hit by the tornado, does not mean there is no difference in them or in their hearts or in their reactions. Though the sufferings or external afflictions are the same, the tornado hit us all, the sufferers remain different in their hearts. Vice and virtue, or the vicious and the virtuous, are not the same, even if they undergo the same torment. Physical illness, loss of job, crop failure, tornado. This is a beautiful quotation. It's on your handout. It's one I've cherished and tried to help near me for years. The fire, which is the trial, the fire which makes gold shine makes chaff smoke. When I read that years ago, it's like something hit me between the eyes. I thought that he just nailed it. He just nailed it. Shame on me for smoking so much. Bad for you anyway, right? Anyway, I've been chaff smoking, right? The same thing, he breaks it down, he's still going metaphorically here. The same flail breaks up the straw, but also clears the grain. And the oil is not mistaken for lees, the byproduct, because both are forced out of the same press. Now he's getting into that ancient agricultural business there. The first one's the one that I'm more attuned with. I'm not so attuned with oil presses and things like that, and I don't think any of us really are. That's right into winemaking and so forth in the old way. But I understand about the fire. Got that loud and clear. Got it loud and clear. That one speaks directly to me in the language. The violence which assails good men to test them, to cleanse and purify them, affects in the wicked their what? Condemnation. Ruin and annihilation in their hearts, in their souls. Thus the wicked, under pressure of affliction, execrate, curse God, and blaspheme, while the good, in the same affliction, it's the same tornado, offer up prayer and praises. They enjoy and exhibit grace under pressure. They're given grace and they exhibit grace under pressure. That's the way it ought to be, right? When we're away from our flesh, we should exhibit grace under pressure. God's in charge. They're not in charge. Joe Biden's not in charge. God's in charge. Poor Joe. Curse, execrate, and blaspheme God. The different reactions, ye shall know them by their fruits. So we can know to some degree. I mean, we don't have absolute knowledge. Only God knows down deep down the heart. But we can see, right, reactions in ourselves and others. Right? We get a rough idea. We get concerns, right? Now, these differing responses show that what matters is not the nature of the sufferer, but the nature, is not the nature of the suffering, but the nature of the sufferer. That's what matters. That's what matters, the nature of the sufferer, not the suffering. Tornado, hit them all. Right? Here's another beautiful quotation as well as on your sheet. Stir a cesspit, and a foul stench arises. Stir up a wicked man and you see ugly behavior, do you not? Invariably. Stir a perfume, on the other hand, and a delightful fragrance ascends. But the movement of stirring is identical. It was the tornado. It was the cancer. It was the loss of job. They all lost their job. Mill shut down. How'd they react? Okay, big mill, big place. Fuji just shut down in Greenwood. 400 or 500 people. How'd those people react? 400 to 500 employees. Boom, job's gone. Sorry, they didn't get much warning. From what I heard, how did they react? Depends on their heart. Some of that's mask, of course, if they had a big bank account, right? Then you may have a little more work to do in investigating their heart. Maybe they're not so worried because they got a bank account. So you have to dig deeper and say, well, what was your heart? What if you didn't have that bank account? Or the job? Then what? Then what is your attitude? Then the truth will start to come out. Now, his next topic is the reasons why the good and the wicked are equally afflicted. And you can ask the question, are they equally afflicted as regards external material bodily afflictions? He uses a phrase to describe this earthly life which may shock people. And he could even disagree with it. And sometimes I've wondered, is he talking about what happened to Rome? And he uses the expression, this universal catastrophe. I thought, whoa, that's strong language. Is he talking about this earthly life, this fallen world that we're living in, this universal catastrophe? We talked last time, we talked about Augustine, about what happened to the mind, didn't we? The different faculties to imagination, to reason, to will, to memory, to all those things. We're broken. The image was broken by the fall, Adam's sin, right? But he's made the claim, this earthly life is a universal catastrophe. Not just the sacking of Rome, which Romans felt was a catastrophe. And you said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You know, this life has got some sweet things about it. Careful. Be careful. Be very careful. Because we're going to talk about the sweetness of this world before long in this meeting. All right. And so you, maybe the next session, but we're going to get to the sweetness of this world and the danger of being of that allurement. So be careful. It's one thing to appreciate nature. I love it. I've got a garden. It's beautiful. Appreciate all the... It's beautiful. We're not talking about that. Of course you appreciate creation and beauty and so forth. We're not talking about that. We're talking about this earthly life and the fallen world and the struggle by the believer with sin himself and sin and those around him. That's what we're talking about. It is a catastrophe. If we knew what it was like to be in good order, like Adam before the fall, we can't even imagine, hardly even imagine that. To be in good order in your heart before the fall, that's, it would take a great act of imagination. We're used to our way, aren't we? And so we don't even understand what we don't even have a clear conception of what Adam was like in his ordered nature, or in what, even better, the nature of the believers in heaven. It takes a great act of imagination to even try to fathom that, what that would be like. It would be a different person, fundamentally, a lot of ways. So we just say, well, I don't know, I like it. I've got property, and I get to watch movies at night, and I have to work too hard, and you know, we get in this mode of a pig and a pigsty. We're a pig, happy pig in the pigsty, in the sun, covered with, you know what, there we are. Maybe that's the image. Grunting and flies buzzing around. Seeing the pig and pig star. This universal catastrophe. The sufferings of Christians have tended to their moral improvement in this earthly life because they viewed them with eyes of faith. These are important notions, of course. The love of truth. In the Christian, you have the love of truth combined with eyes of faith. On the other hand, for the other folk, you've got hatred of truth. Notice it's not indifference. We're going to talk about that. Hatred of truth and eyes of unbelief. You've got these glasses on. The Christian has his eyes of belief. And they slide off sometimes, don't they? Right, mine do. I start suffering more time. I thought, oh boy. So I have to put back my eyes on belief. So you have to have faith. You don't see any kind of relief at this point, but maybe around the corner the Lord's got something. Just got to hang in there. Just got to hang in there. Eyes of faith. Just got to hang in there. Hang tough. Hang tough. Eyes of faith. Oh, eyes of unbelief. Right? hatred of truth. Is it possible to be indifferent to the truth? And I'm going to venture to say, no, it's not possible for a human being to be indifferent to the truth. When you dig down into that soul and that mind, and you say there's only one true God, it's the triune of the Christian faith. And if you could look into the person's heart, you'd find out if they believe it and affirm it and love it, or if they growl and hate it, or any other salient truth of our faith. They're going to have an aversion to it or an attraction to it. Bet on it. They'll never be indifferent. Okay? They won't. Yes?
It's as in love. The opposite of love is not hatred, it's indifference. The opposite of love is indifference or apathy.
I would say the opposite of love, and you'd have to get down to the optics of love, I think, part of it when you go through the philosophical question about it, right? What are we to think of indifference? Right? When does indifference ever come into play? I think the root of indifference when we're talking about the object being truth is always, it's going to devolve back into hatred. Right. It, on the surface, it may be indifference, but you dig down there, and it's going to end up being hatred. That way down in there. Now, eyes of faith, love of truth. The reasons Christians suffer, we're getting to the heart of the matter now, and this will be the discussion for the rest of this period and also into through the next session. First of all, there are two basic reasons. There are, first of all, the afflictions for trial's sake, and the most famous example of that is our brother Job. All right, tried at multiple levels, and as the Lord said, he proved true. But he's tried in the fire of affliction. And so one of the reasons Christians suffer afflictions is just for trial, as we're told in Scripture. And we have 1 Peter 4:12, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened unto you." That's exactly what you're speaking about, right? So we have it there. Augustine says, "So that the spirit of man may be tested, that he may learn for himself what is the degree of disinterested devotion that he offers to God." Notice the word disinterested. There again we go back to loving God for himself because of his wonderful substance and nature, as opposed to just for the goodies he gives you. Right? Back to it. Indifferent. Disinterested devotion to the Lord. Disinterested means loving God for God himself, not for God's gifts to you. Now, not going to spend much time on that. We know there are afflictions for the sake of trial. The other big category to spend the rest of time on will be afflictions for sin. Because of sin. Because of the sin of the afflicted. And there are three basic categories he's talking about here. The first is we live in a fallen world, a sinful world. Christians consider in humility the sins which have moved God's indignation so that he has filled the world with dire calamities. So the Christian is looking around the world and himself and others saying, boy, bad things are happening here. All sorts of things. Why? Why? Well, it's because of sin. What if you had a sin meter? You tried to measure the sheer volume of sinning that goes on in this world every day with how many billions of people? If you had a sin meter, way beyond us, right? I'm not saying the Lord's got a sin meter, but he's on top of everything, is he not? He doesn't need a meter. He knows exactly what, when, where, and why. Everything. Knew it beforehand, right? He's well aware. But the Christian, unlike the unbeliever, has some inkling, has some foreboding when we think in our own rooms, we think, well, there's a lot of sinning going on out there. I'm just waiting for the Lord to fire some lightning bolts. It's coming. You feel a foreboding. We got it coming.
All that sin was placed on Jesus Christ.
We've got it coming.
All that sin, all that ugly stuff, he suffered.
Yes.
In his own body.
Yeah, you can imagine that. You just imagine what went on there. We can have no inkling. We're not even close to being there, as the philosophers would say epistemologically. We can't know. We can't even fathom anything like that. We've never experienced anything like that. But the Christian has a superior self-knowledge because they have, first of all, they have at least a rough conception of what is sin and what isn't sin, unlike the unbelievers. We have a clear view of the good and the bad, and also that all this is going on. Secondly, and this will be the final point, and we'll go into next week talking about the third big situation. Although Christians are free from criminal and godless wickedness, still they do not regard themselves as so far removed from such wrongdoing as not to deserve to suffer the temporal ills which are the recompense of sin. Every one of them, however commendable his life, gives way at time to physical desires, and while avoiding monstrous crimes, the sink of iniquity and the abomination of godlessness, is yet guilty of some sins, infrequent sins perhaps, and more frequent because more trivial. If you can speak that way, peccadillo and so forth. Christians, again, have a superior self-knowledge. They are uniquely aware of sin and self. They're more aware than those next to them who are unbelievers of sin in this world. They have this basic impression of, boy, we're in for it. Judgment. There's going to be judgment. Don't know when, but it's coming. And when it does come, it's going to be there. The first two categories from Augustine about afflictions for sin. We briefly flew over afflictions for trial. The big focus of the remainder will be about righteous rebuking. A Christian is obliged to witness to unbelievers in this world, but more specifically, he is obliged to instruct and at times even rebuke those who profess belief as Christians, but who are falling very substantially short, perhaps in the heresy and so forth, but still claiming the title Christian. So I make that distinction between witnessing to the unbelieving world out there, but also what do we do about the professing Christians who are not? They are not. That'll be the focus. What about the rebukers? And it will get into things like why rebukers are so rare. Why qualified rebukers are so rare. And we're going to talk about Ezekiel 33 and the prophet talking about the watchman. And that will bring us to a discussion of Plato and the beast of public opinion, the opinion of the many. And we're going through various topics there. And Plato is going to help us understand why righteous rebukers are so rare in this earthly life. So I'll wrap up right there. Any questions or comments from what's been said so far? We'll pick up there, talking about the rarity of qualified rebuker in the watchman and how that ties into earthly affliction. No questions or comments at this point? We'll pick up. Yes, sir.
Well, just Christians have this innate knowledge because we have the Holy Spirit living within us.
Innate knowledge of?
Of good, of knowing good.
We do, and we know that it's indeterminate, it's fuzzy, it's sketchy, typically. It's incomplete, of course. But it's when we are not overwhelmed by the flesh, it is the axiom, as Kant would say, of our actions. It is the principle of our actions, when we know the Christian that way. Right, because it's been put into us, the love of the good and the eyes of belief. So it's changing our will, which has changed our hearts. And so we behave differently. Still fighting with the flesh, but there's the force of it there. Other questions, comments? Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for taking us through some of these ideas of one of your great children, Augustine. We thank you for